The first offensive lineman selected in the 1993 draft, Willie Rofe became the anchor of the Saints' offensive line. Rofe played 9 seasons in New Orleans and 4 in Kansas City, earning 11 Pro Bowls. Number 77 was a key component on the Chiefs' 2004 and 2005 teams that led the NFL in total yards. Willie Rofe played in 189 career games and was voted as a member of the 1990s and 2000s NFL All-Decade teams.
Let me tell you, listening audience here at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, it is an honor and a pleasure to bring in arguably the greatest left tackle in the history of the National Football League, certainly in that conversation, Mr. Willie Rofe. Willie, welcome to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show with your host, Ricky Hampton and Michael Robbins.
Thank you for having me.
It's definitely great having you on the show, Willie. But I want our listeners to know that you actually have a basketball background and was a pretty good player growing up in Arkansas playing basketball. And standing at 6'5", I guess you were probably maybe a center, a power forward in high school. Did your basketball background help you as a football player?
It really did. It really helped with my footwork balance, especially when I got to the college level using my hands and quickness. And I was a little more raw in basketball, and I had a lot of fun playing. You know, we used to go all over Pine Bluff and playing a lot of ball outside and played for the Zebras. And back then they had a big tournament called the King Cotton Classic that a lot of big programs, you know, Flint Hill would come to, and Dunbar from Chicago and Memphis School. So, you know, we had a lot of fun. And, you know, I saw Dennis Scott and Stanley Roberts and Jason Kidd and a lot of good players come to that.
So, Willie, did you get the nickname Nasty from basketball, or is it from football?
That was later on. In the NFL, you know, with football, you know, being a prankster and messing with guys, that was, you know, when I got to the NFL that I got that nickname.
Okay.
And Willie, did you ever play against Dick Stanley? Because, you know, a lot of people thought he was even better than Shaq coming through LSU, former assistant coach, our good friend, Coach Abernathy, he was assistant coach to Dale Brown there. They all thought that Stanley was the most talented. Of course, Shaq went on to have a great career. Did you get a chance to play against Stanley in that tournament?
No. Stanley was a little younger than me. You're right, though. I remember how highly touted. I think Stanley was from Mississippi, and he was real, one of the top players in the nation coming out of high school. Obviously, you know, Shaq was a military kid and came over here and then finished up high school ball. And when he got to the NBA, you know, obviously Shaq is one of the greatest NBA players ever played a game with 4 rings, and he's in that top 5 category with centers in my list all time. But, you know, like you said, Stanley Roberts, J.R. Reed, Bobby Hurley, Purvis Never Nervous, Purvis Ellison came through there. So we had a lot of good players that came through that tournament at that time. Chris Mills, I played against L.A. Fairfax one dot. We played them in the second round. So there's a lot of good talent that came through that tournament in the 90s.
All right. So Willie, being an alum of Louisiana Tech, you had a predecessor that ended up winning 4 Super Bowls at quarterback. But now he's put his foot in his mouth by basically criticizing the coach, Mike Tomlin. So, Terry Bradshaw, how do you feel about that, knowing that you guys represent the same college, that he's now belittling the accomplishments of Mike Tomlin?
Well, I didn't know when did this happen. I didn't know anything about him belittling Mike Tomlin, but Mike Tomlin has been an excellent coach for the Steelers, and what did he want, 2 Super Bowls, and the team's always been competitive. So, I think Mike Tomlin has done a great job with the Steelers, and I don't understand why he would be belittling, you know, maybe – he has something personal with the Steelers organization, you know, concerning him. But Mike Tomlin's been a great coach, and you know, you know, everybody's got their own opinion, but like I said, Tomlin, I think in my eyes, has done an outstanding job up there. And I also played at Tech with Antonio Brown's dad, Daniel Kennedy Brown, who went on to have a great arena career. We got him from Fort Scott Junior College, and he was him and Bobby Slaughter were our star receivers at La Tech. He's a little older than Eddie Brown is, but I remember meeting Antonio when he was a real, real little kid.
Okay. Man, you know, as we were talking yesterday, when I was telling you, I thought you were going to be a Detroit Lion, and that draft day, 1993, that day, I mean, that was the word around here. They were going to pick you. They were going to put you on the right side, had Lomas Brown. You got two all-pro tackles. Well, you're going to be a rookie, but obviously highly thought of. And everybody's thinking Barry's going to run for like 2,500 yards a year. Running behind you got, and they had Kevin Glover, an all-pro center. You had a very strong offensive line. But, of course, that changed with the trade that brought Pat Swilling here to Detroit. And with that number 8 pick, the Saints took you. Did you have any idea all this was going on? And especially with your ties to Michigan, where your mom, Georgia Rolfe, actually went to college at Michigan State, and your dad.
Well, you know, that's what made it so ironic was the fact that Wayne Fonts was at Michigan State with my father. Sherman Lewis and Herb Adderley were all at Michigan State together. And I didn't know everything was going to transpire. I just knew that I was projected to go between the 5 and the 8th or 9th pick. And when the Saints traded up, I was happy because I knew I was going to be close to home and close to my family. But with the history with my dad from Michigan State, you are right. You know, looking back on it, I was a little surprised that they would trade the pick because they did. They had to know that, you know, they played with my father. And but, you know, everything works out for a reason. And, you know, I ended up getting off to a great start in New Orleans, and I didn't miss a down until my fourth season. I hurt my knee, but before, back then we only dressed 7 linemen, so you weren't coming out the game. So, you know, everything worked out, and you know, your offense was kind of geared. It wasn't a straight ahead offense. It was more Barry created a lot of stuff on his own, and you know, you kind of let guys get up the field, and they like to throw the ball. So, you know, any system that you know that I played in, you know, I would have fit in. You know, the guy that went behind me, if you remember, Lincoln Kennedy, was highly talented. He probably should have come out his junior year. He'd probably been a top 5 pick, but he was a big guy, you know, 6'6", 340, 350 at the time. And I don't know why Atlanta took him. He was not a run and shoot tackle. You know, he fit more of the Raiders, the pound and ground type of system, and he ended up playing well in Oakland. But, you know, Lincoln and I are good friends, and, you know, I was just so happy to come from where I came from, Louisiana, to make my way into the top 10 and be the first lineman off the board that year. Was a big achievement, especially coming from an independent program. It was just going Division I at the time.
So Willie, how cool was that then, not to have to really go far, you know, from your campus, you know, not go across the country, adjust to a different climate and all that? How cool was it to go there, even though the Saints weren't the, you know, Saints that won the Super Bowl, but you know, still that was the region. Even when you were at Arkansas, that was the regional team, right?
Yeah, it was the Saints were a regional team. Where, you know, most people in Southeast Arkansas are Cowboy fans because Dallas is only 4 hours. But, you know, my grandma and my dad's mom were the big Cowboy fans. But it was Cowboy fans or just whatever team you like. My brother was a Cowboy fan. I was a Steelers fan growing up, so I was a big Steelers fan. I liked the black and gold and yellow, and it was so good because I was so close to home. My dad could drive to every game. He never missed a game in my career other than one game my brother played. And when I got traded to Kansas City, it was about the same distance, 8 hours. So he never missed a game of me playing in Kansas City, home game also. And I went to college only two hours from my house. So obviously he came to all my college games. So me being close to home and close to a lot of families, a lot of kids, and some of them ended up going pro, used to come down to Little League teams, used to come down to New Orleans and bring busloads to games. So being able to see those kids and them being able to be close enough to come and see me. And then because I played in that region and Arkansas didn't have a pro team, we played on TV more, so they got to watch me play more too.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
And Willie, when you talk about your family, man, you come from a great family, and obviously you must have had a great support system, and I'm sure they instilled the values in you that helped you reach the highest apex of football, being elected into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Your mom was the first black Supreme Court judge in the state of Arkansas, and your father was go ahead.
Yeah, female, first black female, and my dad was grew up in the South and was on the Underground Railroad. We talked about this railroad, and definitely one of the first ones to go up to play at Michigan State. And then he was co-valedictorian of his class, and the Arkansas after he hurt his knee, and you know, him and my uncle with the OBGYN went back and had a dental and doctor practice, and were big in the community. Was on the school board 20 years, and my dad's whole life was geared around going back to his hometown and being in that community and being positive and. You know, I grew up in some real good times, you know, born in 70 and the baby boomers and Pine Bluff was really thriving at the time. You know, it's not as populated and kind of gone down now. You know how things are happening into some of those areas like that. You know, Pine Bluff is built around like Port Arthur, Texas, around the railroads and the paper mill were the big factories and plants there. In the railroad, so it was geared around that, and they're trying to, you know, Simmons Bank is big down there, and they're trying to do things to get it back going and get people back moving in the community, and hopefully we can turn it around back there soon. But like I said, it was so great growing up in that community, and I also had my sister went to Harvard and Princeton, and now she's an Episcopal priest. And the bishop that's over her is the bishop that did that great job at that service for the royal wedding, and
okay.
My other sisters in Phoenix. So you know, my family were very high pushed education, and my sisters were my parents were very highly educated. So I knew if I was gonna do something in sports, I needed to achieve at a high level because everybody else was. Achieving a real high level of what they were doing. So, you know, it was very competitive, but, you know, they always pushed me to be the best at what I was going to do, and I took advantage of that opportunity, especially when I had a chance to go pro. And you can't take it for granted, especially when you start getting a little older in the league. And I made sure that every time I stepped on that gridiron after a few years that I was going to be ready to play. You know, I think I did a good job of leaving my mark on that field. And like you said, with my business and everything else now, hopefully I can impact these younger players and these guys. And you know, it's funny, I got a text from Frank Ragno today, and he told me he appreciated my comments as an article in the Detroit Press.
Yeah.
You know, I always try to be positive and help these young guys stay focused and, you know, he's a good kid, and I just want him to make sure he's in. My main thing was getting in camp on time, learning that system, and getting off to the best start he can. You know, you never know what's going to happen with injuries, but, you know, as long as he has that best foot forward, I just want him to, you know, get off to a good start. And, you know, like I said, he comes from a good family. And you always wish good for a guy with character like that on your roster.
Yeah, and for our listening audience, I mean, well, let me just get them caught up because one of the big stories on the radio today here in Detroit was Willie's comments about Frank Ragno, the Lions' number 20 pick in the draft out of Arkansas. He's a 6'5 guard center, and it sure made me feel good to hear you think so highly of him, Willie. So we're happy about that in Detroit, because the thing you got to do, if you can keep Matthew Stafford upright, I mean, he can be a pretty good quarterback.
He can be, and like you said, I mean, me being from Louisiana Tech, I was the first Louisiana player drafted in the first round by the Saints. It wasn't an LSU guy. I'm proud of that. It was me from Louisiana Tech, and then they drafted a running back this year in the sixth round. I think that's the second player they drafted from Louisiana Tech, and he's going to end up playing because Byron Scott, because Mark Ingram got suspended. But, you know, me coming in and them trading Pat Swillen, and people like, who is this Willie Ruff kid that they traded for Swillen? You know, there's a lot of pressure on me to perform. You're trading, you know, I think Swillen was the 91 defensive player of the year for this kid from Tech. So, you know, it's always going to be pressure and expectations for him to get out there and play. And I just want him to get in cap on time. And, you know, I just told him, you know, that just get in. And, you know, his dad's going to be looking down over him, watching him. And, you know, we both lost our dads. You know, he lost his dad very tragically last year. And, you know, my dad had been sick a little while. But, you know, I just told him to get in there and make his family proud. And you know, as long as he does what he needs to do, he lay it out on the line. And I'm gonna be interested to watch him playing. And I will be, other than my Saints and Chiefs, I'll be rooting for the Lions.
Hey, what about playing that left tackle position? I mean, you're always going up against the top pass rusher. You know, nowadays they try to switch him around a little bit, but really they want that guy to put pressure on their quarterback from the blind side. How much is physical ability? How much is preparation and the technical aspects of the position?
Well, it's physical and it's mental. You know, you just have to make sure you take those good sets and make sure you got your fundamentals intact. Because if you start false-stepping and you do some things, these guys are real good. They can notice it, and they're going to take advantage of it. And, you know, they have certain moves they like to rely on. But, you know, if you're not on top of your game, these guys will get after you. And you will tell if a guy, you know, you're injured. So it's a lot that goes into it, and you have to do the best to keep your body feeling as good as you can, especially when you step on that field on Sunday, because you know, nobody cares if you're hurt or not. You got to get out there and play. So, you know, my thing was keeping my weight at a good weight and making sure my body felt good. I went to, especially when you get older, you go to the chiropractor and you get your massages and all that, and you hear about guys like LeBron James paying those guys, you know, it's basketball, but, you know, $1.5-2 million and taking care of their bodies year-round. Tom Brady, you know, it's different now. Guys are year-round, got nutritionists and people with them, and, you know, it's a year-round deal now. You know, it wasn't like that back then. But these guys, you know, their bodies, their livelihood. So, you know, now, you know, with the technology and everything now, they have a monitor when you're doing practice now, where they can see how much your body's heating up, looking at your heart rate, seeing when you need fluids in it. I mean, it's so high tech now. They can monitor all kind of different levels within your body during practice. A lot of these colleges are doing it. It's crazy what they can do now.
Go ahead, Mike.
All right, so Willie, let's go back to your high school days. So you coming out of Pine Bluff. Now, you had Arkansas Pine Bluff there, even though you were born 20 years after where you had to go to HBCUs, but you're in a town where Southern was there. So did you ever consider HBCU, or you just knew you wanted to go to a school that may be Division I and may get you drafted?
That's a good question. I wasn't really worried about getting drafted. I was just worried about getting a scholarship. So,
okay.
Arkansas, UAPB really didn't come after me. That's when Gunslinger, you remember Gunslinger, the coach Jerry Rice and Mississippi Andrew Valley had went to came to UAPB. And then it's funny, I ended up being at La Tech, which is right down the street from Gremlin. So Weston was dry county, so we had to go to Gremlin if you wanted alcohol. So I never really thought about it. I only had the first school to offer me was La Tech. I went on a visit, and they were going to Division One. So, you know, I went to that field. I mean, La Tech was my Alabama to me, you know, coming from Pine Bluff. So it was La Tech. Then A-State, who was Larry Lexwell, was the coach at the time, who went on to work for the Cowboys for a long time, offered me. And then I went to basketball camp when Pippen came out and got Mr. Rebound at UCA Central Arkansas, Southeast Missouri. I'm not sure they took – I got a letter from Connecticut when Calhoun had just got to UConn, I think, that year. But, you know, my dad was 18. This is the – you know, you're going to the military, you're getting a scholarship. I mean, I wasn't academically as focused as I was. My parents were, my sisters were. So my thing was I was just happy to get a scholarship. And, you know, I was 235 when I got there, and they told me I was going to be big and be 300 or whatever before I left. And I thought they were crazy, but it was true. So, you know, I wasn't about going pro. I was just trying to, you know, get a scholarship and see what happened when I got there. So that was my mindset at that time.
Okay.
I appreciate that. I do want to get you to talk about a venture you have going now. It's called Frame Your Game. And I'm actually on the website now, and I was there the other day. You guys got some great stuff on here at www.com, frameyourgame.com.
Yeah. Yeah, we really make a lot of progress. We got some things in the works, so the fans can go to frameyourgame.com, and you can get your favorite team helmet, or you can get plates with your players, with your favorite. We have the NFLPA license, so you can get your favorite players in the helmets, or you can get the players and put them on your car. We also right now you can go to NFL Shop or Fanatics and type in, if you go to NFL Shop or Fanatics, you put in NFL license, NFL helmet license plate, or you put in on NFL Shop, you put in NFL and whatever your player is, like if it's Aaron Rodgers photo license plate or Drew Brees photo license plate, and they will come up, and we have about 20 players that are available on NFL Shop, and we have about 29 helmets that are available. So you can go to frameyourgame.com, or you can go to NFL Shop or Fanatics and also find our products.
And I'm looking at how easy it can come on. They look like they're real easy to come on, looking at the illustrations here, and it's really, really cool. Frameyourgame.com. And for Lions fans, they're easy to take off because, you know, man, around here, it can go bad really quick.
Yeah, so what you do is when you put our slogan is put your helmet on game day. And in Detroit, in Michigan, you have to have a front license plate, correct?
No, not anymore. They used to.
Not anymore. So
not anymore.
For those fans that already have that little, if you already have that metal Lion plate on your car, we also have Michigan State's license right now. If you already have that Lion plate, or you have a plate on your car, the little thing, it all screws in together. So if you already have something, you can put that helmet on top of it or the hat, and it looks good with it on there. All of them are made to fit the license plate, and it all screws in together. Or you can put the bottom part on the back part of your car if you want to. But they're all made to fit the license plate. And if you already have something on there, if you put that helmet on top of it, it's going to look good. So you put your helmet on game day, and if you're worried about somebody messing with it after the game, take it off when you get home, and you can put it on every Sunday. Or if you're going to work and you feel good about it, take it to work. Leave it on there. But, we want you to buy more than one. We want you to get the customized plates with your favorite players, or if you want to, you can get your own picture with your own in your uniform, a selfie. You can send that to us, to our company, go to our website, and we can make customized ones too.
I tell you, you definitely need to get a Barry Sanders here because he's still the most popular Lion around town. He hadn't played since 1998. So that would be a good one. And what I'm going to do, too, Willie, we'll make sure to put the link to the website up on our website, theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com, to make sure everybody can take a look at it because this is it's really cool stuff, man, that you guys got going on.
I was going to say that since we're talking about African-American athletes, it was so special for me and my wife and my kid. We went to the new African-American Museum in D.C. So for anybody listening, you need to go see that museum and to go in there and see the section with the athletes and the baseball, you know, back before in the early 1900s when, you know, the blacks were playing with the whites and then they tell a story of everything, you know, the history of sports and what the African-American athletes have done, track and field and everything that we've done to help bridge that gap with society through sports, you know, it's special. And like I said, it was very special to go in that museum. I went in there once. You can't really get it all in one visit.
Nope.
But I will be going back to that museum in D.C. It's a great museum.
You're listening to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com talk show with your hosts, Michael Robinson and Ricky Hampton. We have the pleasure of being joined by Hall of Fame left tackle Willie Rolfe. We won't keep Willie much longer, but I know Mike has a couple questions, and I got a couple of more to finish up our interview.
Well, my question is this, Willie. We went through a whole year of them basically colluding to keep Kaepernick out, and then your old two teams had a connection to it. He took over for Alex Smith in Kansas City. Well, that ended up going to Kansas City after he took over in San Francisco. And then Drew Brees had some disparaging comments about what he was doing. So how do you feel about the whole scenario and then how Drew Brees from your old Saints kind of be against what he was doing, thinking that he was being unpatriotic?
Well, you know, first of all, it's, you know, that's been a real, real tough issue in this society, in this country, with the violence, with police officers and everything that's going on with the school shootings and everything now that's going on with that, and something's got to be done. And I think they're trying to make progress with these, you know, body armor cameras and stuff of that nature. I will say at the time, the stand he took, I understood it, and I understood at that time it was a lot going on. And at that time, you know, it was I think it was necessary that you know, brought, and he sacrificed a lot for what he gave. Now, I'm not going to say it's the same as Martin Luther King. I mean, what Muhammad Ali had to go through and everything that went on in the Civil Rights Movement. I'm not going to say it's that, but he did take a great stand. I will say now that after a couple years later, you can do things in other ways. You're still employed. You're an employee of a corporation. That's a big business corporation. Okay, all these owners have the bottom line is they got to have people in the stands. So now that statement has been made. And this is the argument they're having. If football season starts and we have another shooting or something and stuff happens, are people going to take a knee or what's going to happen? I do believe that, you know, at that point, they're asking him for him to get signed. Remember with Seattle, that he needed to say that he would not take a knee this fall during the season. So he knows that's going to be the expectations if any team is going to sign him, And I think they have made their point. And you can be active in your community, and the league needs to do more to give these players that have been meeting with the league empowered to do more positive stuff in these communities because they have so much influence around. So I think the NFL should take a higher stand of doing stuff to help these black athletes that want to do positive stuff in the community, like Malcolm Jenkins and these guys with Philly were going to meet with everybody. But I think that guys, they understand it's controversial, and, you know, I understand what the both sides of it. But, you know, the point was made and it was done a couple years ago when they did take a knee. So I think now, you know, I understand the owner's part of it because they got to fill the stands. They got bills to pay, and that's what pays the players that they want guys to not take a knee anymore. So, you know, it's their team and it's their business, and you're at your work environment. So you got to understand if you go to work, you know, you got to go to work and do your job. I mean, at a normal job, a lot of jobs, they don't want you bringing your personal life to your job. But like I said, a point had to be made, and I agree with it, but I think it's time for things to move forward, and I think the teams need to reach out and do more things in the communities to help these black guys get the message across of what they're trying to do. And so that's what I think that they're trying to work on, and hopefully they can continue to make progress with the teams doing more in these communities other than just selling tickets and using athletes until they retired and then, you know, forgetting about the athletes and not doing stuff in the community that they need to be doing other than doing stuff to make the teams look good, but really doing something to help these situations. That's my opinion about it.
That's well said. But Mike, did you want to follow up?
No, the only thing I would say is that when people compare football and all that to a regular job, the one thing I would say is that they don't force you to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance at a regular job. So that's the caveat that they brought in. Remember, the NFL didn't have you guys doing that at first, and it became this whole patriotic thing of we're going to make you guys come out here and make sure you stand for the national anthem. And I think a lot of it happened probably after 9/11. So a lot of that,
And you're right. The military paid them to do that,
right,
too.
Yeah,
also, if you remember, mm-hmm, this started in the NBA. It started with Craig Hodges, and it also started with Abdul Raouf, Chris Jackson, when he was in Denver. And he didn't want to stand. Mm-hmm. Now, in the 90s, when he did this in the 90s, he really took a lot of backlash. Craig Hodges never got signed again. And Chris Jackson, when Abdul Raouf, that was pretty much the end of his career. Now, we're in a different time now, so I understand your point that they're not making you stand. But it is the NFL, and the owners, like you said, now they can keep the guys in the locker room if they want to do it that way. Now they like to do it, now they bring them out. But to my point, you know, they do have a bottom line, and they are paying these guys a lot of money. And like I said, if the teams will show, this is my point. If I'm a player, teams will show that they are trying to get in these communities and do stuff off the field to try to help and show attention and give back and doing more in these black communities, then the guys would probably want to stand for the anthem. But the teams have to show the guy, the athletes, that they want, that they're going to put the money where their mouth is and are going to do stuff in these communities where they feel like these teams are really trying to do something, not just get their bottom line and worried about just football. That's where football's going to have to transition and be more about football and be more about doing other things. Now you see J.J. Watts is doing it on his own.
Yeah.
J.J. Watts has a little different platform. You saw the money he raised, and he's paying for all those funerals for those kids. But J.J. Watts is not African-American. So, you know, so they don't gave all that money for him with the charity because, you know, it's J.J. Watts. Now, the black athletes, it's a little harder to do things, and you understand that it is still a good old boy system in the NFL. They like running things a certain way. It's different in basketball because there's too many black star athletes and basketball players, not that many of them, and they're making a whole lot of money. So you don't see NBA guys not standing for the anthem because they want to sell their shoes and they represent Nike and these big companies, so they just don't do it that way. And it's a lot more activism in the NBA that they do a lot of stuff so the black athletes are happy because of what the NBA is trying to do.
Good points from both of you guys on that topic. And really, I think, you know, having covered the NFL for 25 of my 33-year career, I don't think people realize the business end of the game because they just see you on Sunday. They don't see all the stuff you guys go through during the week and in the off season just to get ready to play on Sunday. They think you play on Sunday and you know, you just chill until that next Sunday. Can you tell us a little bit about all the things it takes for you to prepare to play even before you even get to training camp?
No, it's a job. So right now players are in OTAs. And before it used to be more than this. Now when I first came to the league, we just showed up for mini camp and a few things and you were pretty much on your own until they started putting the workout bonuses in there and making guys be there in the off season. But around the late 90s, because they wanted to keep tabs on you and see how you were doing and making sure you're working out, they started you start training in April, you go into May and June and you start OTAs, which is practicing. They say it's voluntary, but a lot of guys have workout bonuses tied into this, so it can be from $300,000 that you get for participating in that off-season program. That lasts toward the end of June, give or take. You get a little time off, and then you get a break in July before training camp for about a month, and then you show up at training camp probably most guys toward the middle end of July, and you go into training camp till you go, which you're in a dorm or wherever you are, and you with the team practicing for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Then you go back to your city and you start playing your preseason games. And then when you start the regular season, Monday is a film and watch and work out. Tuesday, during the work week, is your day off around the league. Wednesday, you're there at 7 in the morning, film study, working out in the training room, practicing, and then you 7, 8 to 5, Thursday 8 to 5, Friday usually 8 to 2 or 3. You're either traveling or you staying at home. And Friday is a shorter day, and then Saturday you either traveling. Some teams leave on Friday, matter where they're playing. If it's a long road trip, Saturday you're either traveling or you meeting and everything with the team. You off early because you got to go catch the plane. Or you show up later that night for curfew, and you get ready for the game on Sunday. So, and that's pretty much repeated for the course of the season, unless you have a bye week. So it is a job, and you have to show up every day, and then guys go in there on their day off and watch film and work out. So pretty much guys are at the facility and up there all day, every day, and until 4 or 5 o'clock at night during the season every day.
Hey, look, you are a dominating left tackle. I mean, dominating. But was there anybody that ever gave you problems throughout your career and some of your favorite matchups? And did you ever get a chance to play against Reggie White?
Yeah, you know, my rookie year, Reggie and I was in – me and Reggie were friends. And Keith Jackson and him were very close. He's from – Keith Jackson, the tight end, is from Little Rock, Arkansas, who played at Oklahoma, and had a real good career. But Keith and Reggie were close, and I was in the movie Reggie's Prayer with Reggie. But I met Reggie before my rookie year. Keith had a basketball benefit in Arkansas, and I played in it. Reggie was in it. And my rookie year, I played right tackle, and I got to play Gorgas Reggie in preseason, and we played him in the regular season at the Superdome. And I had a pretty good game against Reggie. But it was guys in the division that gave you more problems. Chuck Smith had a real good game against me in 97. And that was a learning curve for me to learn how to be more of a pro and take care of myself. You know, you play a couple of years, you get the big head, and that was a wake-up call game for me. And, you know, God, Mike Rucker, a guy that had power and could bull me and get in my chest or long arms, gave me problems more than a guy that was just trying to run around me. So, Freeney, you know, Derek Thomas, those guys, you know, I played good against them. But, like I said, a guy that had power, Sean Jones, long arms, you know, we get into you, Rucker, you know, a few times, gave me more problems. So, you know, it wasn't always, you know, it's like anything else. It wasn't always the all-pro Hall of Fame guy. You know, when you get to a point where you're a real good football player, everybody's going to give you the A game. So you got to be ready to play every week.
So, Willie, you play in New Orleans in most of the 90s, and then you went to Kansas City. Now, while you were in Kansas City, Hurricane Katrina happened. So what did you see as how New Orleans changed from when you played there in the 90s and even early 2000s? And then that hurricane happened, and then how it's recovered since then. So how have you seen New Orleans resurrection, I guess you could say?
Well, you know, it's come back, but it's still not back. You know, the east, you know, the Michoud area, the out east where a lot of the blacks lived, you know, where the levees weren't as good, it's still not the same. You know, the restaurants and businesses and stuff there is not the same as it was in the 90s. Those communities were thriving. They had Eastover, a big community where Pat lived, and, you know, Cash Money guys, and a lot of people with a real nice area that were blacks in the gated community had that was thriving. I mean, those areas are not there because the businesses haven't gone back. So, you know, you have Kenner and Metairie, people that know about the airport in Old Metairie, and downtown New Orleans is doing great. But like I said, some of those areas in the Lower Ninth Ward and out east, you know, it's Little Woods is still not what it was. And a lot of people left and they just, you know, went to Texas or Houston and Dallas and stuff, and they, you know, just Atlanta, you know, and they didn't come back.
Well, man, let me tell you, well, this has been just a blast to be able to spend a few minutes with you, talk a little football, talk a little basketball. People didn't know you had game, but now they do. Hey, who you like in the NBA playoffs?
Well, you know, I'm a big LeBron fan, and always root for the Cavs. And my wife is a Golden State fan, so you know she's Steph Curry and these guys. So I got the game paused right now, so I don't want y'all to tell me what's going on. But hopefully, I saw Houston was playing better, and I'm gonna watch and see if Houston is gonna do anything tonight. But if they don't, this series is over. But we'll see what LeBron and those guys can do. LeBron is kind of reminds me of Tiger. You know, when Tiger was playing at his best, he would figure teams out and the course out, and then he would pick them apart. And I think they figured out Boston, and these guys are getting more confidence. So, you know, I think it may be another Cavs Golden State in the finals, and I don't know if they can beat them, but this Boston team is going back home. We'll see what happens with the Cavs. But like I said, I'm a big LeBron fan. And I was a Lakers fan, obviously, back in the Boston Lakers heyday, and a Bulls fan when Pippen and Jordan, and like a lot of us back in that day. I know y'all were the Bad Boys, but I was a big Chicago fan.
Hey, Willie, Big Nasty, you would fit in right here with the Bad Boys, man, because they would put you down if you come.
They were tough. They were
absolutely
tough.
Absolutely.
Willie, I'm actually out here in Golden State Country. I'm out here in the Bay Area, so I get it all around me. But I'm like you. I like LeBron, and I wanted to see the Cavs win. But I'm right here in the Bay Area, so I'm surrounded by Golden State love. So I know the feeling.
Yeah, well, it's gonna be tough. It's gonna be tough for anybody going up against them again.
Yep.
Yeah. But you're right about LeBron. He's the most versatile player I've ever seen. And you know, this whole thing with people who's the best. I mean, whoever you like is a subjective thing anyway. Like you know, some people think you're the greatest left tackle in the game, but there are other great ones too. Like Ogden was a great one. But it's just great
Ogden,
to be in
Munoz.
That conversation. But
Munoz, yeah, it's great to be in the conversation.
It is. Well, hey, man, you got to come back and talk some more football with us at some point. And make sure to our listeners to go to frameyourgame.com. Isn't that correct? Frameyourgame.com.
That's correct. Or NFL Shop of Fanatics and type in NFL football license plate helmets. And we got some stuff in the works. So I'll be back on in the fall when we get stuff going and during the season to talk about it again.
Yes, sir.
Ricky, thank you. Now, you got Joe Johnson that's from your area. You like him as a player?
The basketball player?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Joe was an excellent basketball player. Joe's, you know, they're not letting him, I don't know why they're not letting him play, but Joe's from Little Rock, and I played with Joe Johnson, two defensive end, but yeah, Joe Johnson had a great career, man. He's he had a good run in Utah a couple of years ago, but he's had a great career.
Yeah, 16-17 years, I think, in the league. And Will, your family, just outstanding. And congratulations to you and going in with your mom at the Black – you guys –
Arkansas Black Hall of Fame.
Absolutely.
The Arkansas Black Hall of Fame.
Nice. Yeah, that's well-deserved, brother. That is well-deserved.
Thank you very much.
Well, hey, we're going to call it a night, and Willie, join us this fall. We'll check back in with you. For Ricky Hampton and Michael Robinson, this has been the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show. Check us out on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com website, and we will put up the information on Frame Your Game along with this interview on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. So we'll see you guys next week. Good night. God bless. Take care.
Peace.